From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. We start this hour in Washington, where three Senate Democrats filed a lawsuit today saying President Trump's appointment of Matthew Whitaker to be acting attorney general was unconstitutional because Whitaker didn't go before the Senate for confirmation. Meanwhile, Democrats are trying to decide whether to make Nancy Pelosi Speaker of the House again or go in a new direction. Let's bring in Mara Liasson, NPR national political correspondent. Mara, let's start with the lawsuit. Where does Whitaker's appointment stand at the moment?
Well, right now, he is the acting attorney general. There are several suits, actually, that have been filed against his appointment, saying it was unconstitutional. He hasn't gone through before the Senate. But for right now, he is in that job. He is overseeing the Mueller investigation, which means potentially he could tell Mueller, no, you can't indict someone. No, you can't subpoena the president. But it also means that when Democrats take over in January, they will be able, as they've said they will do, to call him up to the Hill to ask him about every decision he makes regarding the Mueller investigation.
And the idea that it's unconstitutional, there are a lot of people that get appointed to jobs in interim periods, right, without Senate confirmation.
He could be an interim acting attorney general, but generally, if you want to move someone over to a Senate-confirmed position, they have to be Senate-confirmed. In other words, Mick Mulvaney, who, as you know, has many jobs in the administration, conceivably could have also been the attorney general named to be attorney general without having to go before the Senate because he already has been Senate confirmed.
Okay. Meanwhile, we are 2 weeks almost after the midterm elections. There are five House races still undecided, but it does seem every day like the blue wave gets a little bit bigger. What is left and what kind of majority will Democrats have at this point in the House?
Right. It's almost like a literal tsunami. If you've ever seen a picture of a tsunami, the waves aren't very tall. They just keep on coming further and further into shore. They've got 35 net pickups now. They could get as high as 40, although that is unlikely. Most people think they'll get to 37 or 38. And that's a pretty good majority.
That's a big wave.
Yeah, that's a big wave. Yep.
Yeah. And what about for Democrats? They're trying to decide whether to keep Nancy Pelosi as the speaker or make her the speaker yet again or bring in somebody else.
I think that that's still to be determined. But Nancy Pelosi, right now, you could say she doesn't have the votes for speaker. There are a number of Democrats who promised during the campaign that they wouldn't vote for her. A lot of them were running in Republican districts, battleground districts. The question is, are there enough of them to deny her the job of speaker? What's happened over the last couple of days is you see all sorts of progressive groups pushing back against the anti-Pelosi people. Most of the people who've said they don't want her to be speaker are more moderate Democrats, a lot of men. There have been women representatives who say this is sexist. She's a woman. She's took us over the finish line. She's been one of the most effective speakers ever. And the big question, I think, for Nancy Pelosi is she is a consummate deal maker. What kind of deals is she going to make to get the votes she needs to be the speaker? Will she put a kind of succession in place where she somehow anoints younger, fresh faces in the Democratic caucus that will suggest that when she said she was going to be a transitional figure, she really meant it? In other words, she wasn't going to be speaker for very long. Mm-hmm. Will she shake up the leadership team? Don't forget, it's not just Nancy Pelosi who's in her late 70s. Everyone in the Democratic leadership is. So these are all things that she can do. And we're waiting to see what she comes up with. And don't forget, we do not have at this moment anyone running against her yet.
Well, we'll see what happens there. We do have another election coming up, amazingly, just in the next couple of weeks in Mississippi. There's going to be a special election runoff for a Senate seat. Cindy Hyde Smith is the Republican. President Trump's going to hold rallies for her, and she is running against Democrat and former Agriculture Secretary Mike Espy. She's made some gaffes recently. There's one where she joked about a public hanging. What are her prospects at this point? Does this look like a competitive race?
I think it's more competitive than most Republicans would like it to be, but I think she's still the odds-on favorite. Mike Espy is African-American, so when she made a joke about getting a front-row seat at a public hanging, that Too many people seem to have racial overtones, although she says it was just a joke. She also talked about suppressing the liberal vote at certain colleges. Many people took that comment to mean historically African-American colleges. But I think that she's still the favorite. Mike Espy would have to get a big chunk of the white vote to defeat her. And don't forget, they ran first in a three-way race with a Tea Party Trumpist candidate who came in third.
Right.
If Chris McDaniel had been the one to go to the runoff, Espy would have had a much better chance.
Okay, just briefly, Mara, there was an interview with Fox News host Chris Wallace over the weekend. President Trump explained why he didn't go to Arlington National Cemetery on Veterans Day after not going to another ceremony for soldiers in France. Here he is.
I should have done that. I was extremely busy on calls for the country. We did a lot of calling, as you know.
But this is Veterans Day.
I probably, in retrospect, I should have. And I did last year.
How's that going over, Mara?
He actually didn't last year, but the operative words there is, I should have done that. That is an extremely rare expression of regret by the president of the United States, who never, ever says he made a mistake.
Mara Liasson, NPR national political correspondent, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, to Colorado now. The Centers for Disease Control report that suicide among young people has tripled since the 1940s. About 4,600 people between the ages of 10 and 24 commit suicide every year. And Colorado has one of the highest rates. Well, the state's attorney general recently funded a $2.8 million initiative for pediatric mental health. And as the Mountain West News Bureau's Ali Budner reports, that includes funding for better resources in schools.
Camille Vallée is a junior at Goal Academy in Pueblo, Colorado. She wants to become a zoologist, and just like any high schooler, she says sometimes she feels stressed.
Yeah, what's stressful is, you know, getting your classes done, stuff on time.
But she says the stresses at her old school were way worse.
There was this, like, one set group of bullies that just bullied everyone, and, like, they would talk about me in the bathrooms when I was there. They would just call me names and just were really mean.
She says she tried to reach out for help.
I first took a stance by going to my teacher and telling her, and then she went to the principal, but that didn't do anything, so my mom got involved, but they didn't do anything for that either. Like, even I got bullied by the teachers.
How did that feel?
It felt terrible. Like, you couldn't do anything, like you were trapped.
To make things worse, it was bad at home as well. Her father had left the family, and her sister was struggling with suicidal thoughts. It was all too much. Camille dropped out, and her mom homeschooled her until they found Goal Academy, a charter program with high schools around Colorado. Both she and her sister enrolled.
It's a really open place to just talk, to get your feelings out, to say what's going on.
That's the environment Carolyn Gary strives for. Gary is the chief strategy officer for Goal Academy.
We've had students that have come back to us and they've said, because you reached out to me and you cared and you asked me how I was doing, that got me to tomorrow. That's huge.
She says Goal Academy has always made mental well-being a priority. A lot of the students are high risk in terms of mental health struggles, but she says it was a cluster of suicides 2 years ago that made them reevaluate and ramp up that focus even further.
How could we move from looking at it from a crisis perspective and after the fact to really getting upstream and finding out what is happening before, you know, that student really jumps into the river and you're trying to get them out.
She decided that getting upstream would require several strategies, starting with implementing the suicide prevention program, Sources of Strength. It's a nationwide program that encourages peer-led support groups where students help each other recognize the people they can turn to and trust in their lives. Gary says the program has been really successful, but she still had a burning question. Why the high suicide rate? Was it because Colorado was growing and support services weren't keeping up? Was it funding?
Or is it the fact that we, as a group, have not said, hey, this is a problem, and let's get into each and every community and sit and listen to what that community needs to get ahead of it?
So she was excited when she found out a statewide nonprofit had done exactly that.
We spent the last year researching best practices around school-based mental health.
Andrew Romanoff directs Mental Health Colorado. He and his colleagues traveled around the state hosting conversations with schools, families, communities, and professionals. They then distilled what they found into a mental health toolkit for schools.
10 strategies, in fact, that schools can pursue, whether it means screening kids or putting more mental health professionals in the school building or building social and emotional learning into the curriculum.
The 60-page guide is available for free online and also includes tips on how to find funding for some of the things they recommend. Now, some new state funding might help make things easier. The Colorado Attorney General just issued a nearly $3 million grant. It will go towards better childhood mental health resources for rural areas and pediatric hospitals, as well as the implementation of Romanoff's mental health toolkit statewide. Carolyn Gary at Goal Academy in Pueblo strongly believes schools will benefit from using the toolkit. But she also thinks there's one daily solution that doesn't require toolkits, training, or extra funding at all.
And it's about ensuring students who feel they are invisible and not known to make sure that they are visible and they are known.
For Here and Now, I'm Allie Budner.
Maybe last week you heard that Kanye West and Kim Kardashian called private firefighters to save their $50 million mansion from the wildfires and were blasted for employing what have been called concierge firefighters. But it turns out private wildfire fighting has been around for years, mainly through insurance companies. And this story got us wanting to know more. David Torgerson is president of Wildfire Defense Systems. They operate in 21 states. He's in Billings, Montana. And David, your company wasn't the one that reportedly put out the fires at the Kardashian West home, but you do similar work. How does it work?
Sure. We primarily work for insurance companies, and we have since 2008. And so the way this model works is that the insurance companies have a wildfire program, and we are their service provider for that. And we dispatch engines in a very similar fashion to how our federal government tracks fire and dispatches engines in regions. We mm-hmm. operate in a similar fashion.
But you're sending yours to the clients of the insurance company.
That's correct.
Right. And what do you say to people who take umbrage at that, who are, you know, first of all, just finding out that Kimye, as they call Kim Kardashian and Kanye West, you know, might have an insurance company that, you know, will call a private firefighter? I mean, they think that's elitist.
Well, we certainly don't see it that way, and I don't believe that that's the case at all. This has been going on for 11 years. We've responded to over 550 wildfires on behalf of the insurance industry. And these are offerings that the insurance companies are doing at no cost to the policyholders. So this is not a pay-to-play, and it never has been. Mm-hmm. It's you just need to pick the insurers that have this, and the insurers have found over time that this is a very effective way to serve their policyholders. You know, mitigate losses, and the insurers absorb the costs.
Well, and they absorb the cost because it's a far greater cost to, let's say, replace a $50 million mansion or even a, you know, a $100,000 home. So you're saying it's, you know, it's across the board. You could just as easily go to a fire of a client who's not in a mansion.
Oh, that's exactly right. The vast majority, in fact, more than 90% of the homes in the programs we serve are average value.
Okay.
There's nothing particular about the high net worth. There's no minimum policy levels. You just have to pick the insurer that has that program, and you can have your agent or broker look it up.
Okay, there's so many questions here. So you say it doesn't come at a cost to the insured, but surely they must pay more for that.
They do not.
They don't.
It's a common misconception that this is a pay-to-play or concierge. And that's just not the case.
So, David, what are some of the companies, the insurance companies, who are using your and other services?
Sure. We work for nearly a dozen insurance companies now. You know, one of the big innovators was Chubb Insurance, and they are a high net worth. So it is true that we serve high net worth insurers. But USAA Insurance, which is a company that serves our military, active military and veterans and their family, we work with big insurers and we work with smaller mutual regional insurers. So companies like Mutual of Enumclaw out of Washington State, who insure in a region in the Northwest and some down into California. And so, you know, even at a smaller insurer scale, they have found that these customer service, the ability to contribute to not having losses has been sustainable for all kinds of insurers. Mm. You know, we work with Cincinnati Insurance and many others.
Okay, so how does this work? I mean, do you coordinate it with the local authorities? Because if you're sending trucks to privately battle some flames that are impacting a client, that in fact could help firefighters. They don't have to go there. So how does this work? How do you coordinate?
Well, this has been going on, like I say, again, for over a decade. And 96% of the time, our government officials that are running the fires and controlling the evacuation zones have seen the value in allowing these insurance program engines, or insurance resources, we call them, to come in and contribute to the survivability of these homes. So we check in with the incident command. We get access granted. We communicate. We coordinate. But this is not new. For the last 40 years, private resources have been working on wildfires for the government. And we have been one of those contractors as well since 2001. The difference here is that this is something that we've brought to the insurance industry so that they can contribute and provide services to their policyholders. It's supplemental. It's not taking away from any process. It's adding to resources. The people that we have are firefighters. They've been working in fire for decades. They've worked at state and federal levels. They are essentially have the exact same certifications under the national system.
We took a look back at firefighting. It started, at least the notion that we're familiar with, in London, you know, in the 1700s. And it was insurance companies that had their own brigades because they all had something at risk. But then you get to the 1900s here in the U.S. It evolved into this professional force using new technologies. People understood that it couldn't just be everyone running out and grabbing a bucket. It had to be more professional. And also that city governments could centralize the use of them, decide where they get sent, and also centralize the money that was to pay for them. Do you worry at all that, you know, so many things are being privatized, that you may start eroding what is a matter of civic pride to a lot of people, that they have their own fire department that represents their city?
It's not one or the other. We're getting a situation here where the government service replaced the insurance wildfire service 100 years ago. We've come back now since 2008, and where the insurance programs are supplemental and helping. Fire is getting to be a bigger problem. Mm. We're not eroding anything. You can never have enough resources during a wildfire as long as they're properly coordinated and properly trained.
Yeah. I'm still stunned. I mean, the perception is, and it would be, especially when the name Kardashian gets involved, that this is an elite program. It's, for the rich who are paying extra and depleting resources. I mean, that's what the headline feels like. It's still hard to believe that anybody can get this service if they get the right insurer to offer it, and they don't pay any more for it. And I understand, too, that it's not just that your company fights fires. You also fireproof properties?
Yeah, our mission is a little different when we work with the insurance industry. And remember, we can get dispatched on a fire by the government or the insurance industry.
Right.
But we do a lot of work in the insurance industry because – you know, we can dispatch directly. In our government service, all of our public resources go out first, and then they call for resources that are public from other areas, and then the last ones to go out are the contractors. In this case, we're allowed to work more directly and dispatch directly to those fires.
Well, in the meantime, you've said fires are getting worse. I'm presuming you mean, the global warming and its effect, and it seems like ideas outside of the box like this, and as you said, it's not really that outside of the box, been going on for a while, are going to have to be used even more.
Well, I think Governor Brown in California has said this really well. This is the new normal, and expect more of it for one reason or the other. We live with it every day. You know, in 2008, we were not working as intensely with it. Our seasons were shorter as we were working with these insurer programs. And then each year we would add, a couple of weeks, and we're dispatching to fires every month of the year.
David Torgerson, president of Wildfire Defense Systems, a private firefighting company. David, thank you so much for talking to us about it.
Yeah, thank you very much.
And a couple of notes. David says that the Kardashian Wests may have called a private firefighting company outside of their insurance coverage. That is rare, but it happens. And we checked with a few insurance companies, and they confirmed they do offer this private wildfire fighting service for free to customers in certain fire-prone zip codes. But David says you won't see private trucks coming down the street in places that don't have wildfires. And And now a quick check-in in Kansas, where last week, Leavenworth County Commissioner Lewis Klempt said this to Trevise Pendleton, an architect on a project that Klempt disagreed with. She was also the only African-American in the room.
I don't want you to think I'm picking on you, because we're part of the master race. You know you got a gap in your teeth. You're the master race. Don't ever forget that.
I don't want you to think I'm picking on you because we're part of the master race, meaning the white people in the room, and you've got a gap in your teeth. You're the master of this. Klempt has declined comment, except to say he meant it as a joke. KCOR's Brian Ellison is here. Brian, what's the latest on this?
Well, the latest, Robin, is that over the weekend, the governor of Kansas, Jeff Collier, joined a growing chorus of folks calling for Leavenworth County Commissioner Lewis Klempt to resign. He said, quote, racial and discriminative language have no place in our society, and most especially when spoken by someone holding a public office. And he called the remarks inappropriate and unacceptable and not reflecting the values of the county he represents. You know, I should add, Robin, that the county administrator has made a comment that said the comments are being misconstrued, that that the intention of the commissioner was to say that both he and the city planner who was speaking were part of the master race, that they both have gaps in their teeth. It still was an odd use of the term.
Yeah, to say the least. Look, Klempt only has 2 months left in office. City officials held a special meeting last week calling him for his resignation. But this isn't the first time he's made controversial comments. A year ago, he made remarks about federal holidays for black leaders. So what is the sense of where this is going?
That's right, back in December. And of course, we should note that he was only appointed to this office in October of 2017. He had served previously on the commission more than a decade ago, but back in 2017, he praised Robert E. Lee, said he was a wonderful part of history. He leaves office in January. He didn't run for re-election to fill this this unexpired term that he was appointed to. So, you know, it's possible this is the last we'll hear of Lewis Klempt after all of this, but still a lot of folks are saying it's important for him to resign because of the unfortunate attention he's bringing to the county at this time.
And by the way, Trevise Pendleton is an experienced city planner. Has she said anything?
She has not made comments publicly. She has let other folks respond and chosen not to respond. Herself.
KCOR's Brian Ellison, thank you.
Thanks, Robin.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Saudi Arabia's King Salman bin Abdulaziz gave his first major speech today since the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi earlier last month. He made no mention of the killing or of accusations that his son, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, ordered it. BBC Middle East analyst Sebastian Usher was there at the speech. He joins us from Riyadh. Sebastian, what did King Salman say in his speech?
Well, there was an anticipation about his speech, but there wouldn't normally be, of course. This is the set speech every year. Generally pretty bland, just laying out the basic kind of foreign and domestic policy. And that's what this was. I mean, very little sense of the urgency, perhaps, that the rest of the world could be engendering in Saudi Arabia over the issue of Jamal Khashoggi.
What is the latest on how much the Crown Prince was involved in that killing? Last week, prosecutors announced they were going to push for the death penalty for 5 people in connection with the murder. But the news that appears to be coming out in recent days is that there's more evidence that this was probably ordered by the Crown Prince.
Yes, but remember the different sources that this information is coming from. The public prosecutor, that's in Saudi Arabia. The Saudis have been trying every way they can to insulate the Crown Prince from any involvement. That's difficult with audio recordings. It's now essentially been confirmed. And we had that wrapped up in the CIA report that was featured very, you know, massively in the US media and across the world. Mm-hmm. And of course, it's completely an opposite story. The CIA concluded that such a crime, such a mission could not have been carried out without his say-so. And we're waiting, aren't we, to hear from President Trump what he's going to say after his full briefing he's talked about from the CIA, which he says he's going to have in the next 2 days.
Well, we did hear from President Trump just over the weekend. He spoke with Chris Wallace on Fox News Sunday and was asked if he had heard the tape of the killing. And here's what he said.
Why don't you want to hear it, sir?
Because it's a suffering tape. It's a terrible tape. I've been fully briefed on it. There's no reason for me to hear it. In fact, I said to the people, should I? They said, you really shouldn't.
How much is the future of Saudi Arabia's leadership and Prince Mohammed bin Salman's future tied to what the Trump administration wants to be done?
Well, in a sense, it's neither what the Saudis want or necessarily perhaps the Trump administration or President Trump himself. It's how the sheer weight of evidence as it comes out and how irrefutable it becomes that will force the Trump administration and the authorities in Saudi Arabia into something that they've made quite clear they don't want. President Trump has said time and time again he is loath to do anything that will upset what he's called a spectacular alliance with Saudi Arabia. How long the Trump administration, how long the Saudis can continue with that if the pressure doesn't relent in any way and if the evidence becomes, as I say, so utterly uncontestable that there's no way out for Mr. Trump, but to say, yes, the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman is responsible. Now, we haven't, I think, yet reached that stage, but that will be a very interesting moment. What does the U.S. then do?
That's the BBC's Sebastian Usher in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. Sebastian, thank you.
Thank you.
And we're coming up on the holidays, the time to strengthen the bonds of family and the ties that bind or strangle. For many, those ties have been severed. We've heard celebrities talk about it. Here's Modern Family actress Ariel Winter with Ellen DeGeneres in 2016. Ariel cut off her mother.
It has been very sad for me, but at the same time, it's been much better for me emotionally and physically to be on my own and have a better, safer household and support system. I don't really talk about the reason that I don't speak to my mother. It's kind of been publicized, but the reason I don't really share that is because I want to give her the same respect that she didn't give to me publicly.
And Green Bay Packers quarterback Aaron Rodgers and his brother Jordan famously don't speak to each other. Jordan was on the reality show The Bachelorette and talked about being close with another brother, but not Aaron.
It's just kind of the way he's chosen to do life. And I chose to stay close with my family and my parents and my brother. And so, yeah, that's just it's not ideal. And I love him. And you know, I can't imagine what it's like to be in his shoes and have the pressure he has and the demands from people that he has. Don't have hard feelings against him. It's just how things go right now.
Studies show this is far more common than people think, but we learned recently some people don't even know there's a name for it. Well, it's estrangement. It can be emotionally fraught. Many people get professional help. But we want to learn more about it, and there are only a handful of scholars who study estrangement. Christina Sharp is one. She's an assistant professor of communication at the University of Washington. Christina, professor, first of all, define estrangement.
Basically, we think of it as a process where at least one family member is voluntarily and intentionally creating distance with another family member or family members because of an ongoing negative relationship. And people ask me whether I think estrangement is a product of like children being too entitled. But I've found that the majority of people I talk to sought distance for very serious instances of abuse or neglect. People don't become estranged for arbitrary reasons.
Well, and, you know, there are 12-step rooms where people who come from families that have problems of alcoholism or, as you said, abuse, you hear a lot about estrangement there. People just feel they have to distance themselves. But then on the other hand, we're reading about parents who are completely shocked when their children estrange themselves from them. They can't see a reason.
So, yes, so it's very interesting when you talk with both sides of that parent-child couple. So adult children, at least those who I've just talked to, know exactly why it happened. Parents are much more likely to say, I have no idea how this happened, and it's just like an emotionally tragic occurrence between them. So it's hard because we're never really able to capture both of the people together.
Yeah.
Obviously, a lot of times, at least one of them doesn't want to have anything to do with the other. And sometimes it's just an issue of safety.
Well, then, what do you tell the remaining, the rejected family member? Because Psychology Today describes, you know, parents, for instance, who have separation anxiety. It's like a death for them. And, you know, what? So how do they handle that?
Absolutely. It's something we call ambiguous loss, where even though the person isn't physically gone, they're psychologically gone. And it's extremely difficult because it accompanies something called disenfranchised grief, which is where this grief isn't acknowledged by people. So oftentimes these people aren't getting any support because it's very hard to talk about. I'm not a clinician, but I think that it's really important that they surround themselves with people who can offer support without judgment.
Yeah. But what about the person who's doing the estranging for whatever reason? Because you say they often do it for reasons of safety. But can't that still feel incredibly guilt-ridden? You're cutting yourself off from family with everything society tells you that's supposed to mean.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that estrangement is, especially for the person who initiates it, can be simultaneously positive and negative. So estrangement can be a healthy solution to an unhealthy environment. But we also live in a culture where we ask about each other's families quite often. And then the holidays bring up times when we think about being with family. So a lot of people who I talked to really had uncertainty about whether they were good people. Mm. They would say things like, prisoners and rapists probably have I heart mom tattoos, but I don't. I don't love my parents. And what does that mean?
What does that make me? Yeah. And I'm sure you come across ambiguity, too. I have to cut myself off from my parent for my own safety and because they're not going to change. But there's a yearning for a parent.
Sure. And I think this is where something called, we call it voluntary kin, is really important. And it's the family that we create for ourselves.
Well, and we're coming up on Thanksgiving. We know about Friendsgiving, you know, people who have Thanksgiving with the family they choose.
Yeah, absolutely. These relationships can become extremely important. And as someone who studies communication, a family can be more than just blood ties. A family can be people who we spend time with, the people who do the behaviors of family. And so there's nothing to say that family can't be people who we interact with, who we love, who take care of one another. So I think it's really a nice opportunity for people to resist that idea that you can't choose your family, but you can choose your friends. You absolutely can choose both.
Look, Christina Sharp, having researched this and met so many people who are in estrangement in some way, you know, can you talk about just the depth of it? You know, for those who are thinking, this, I can't imagine this. You know, I get mad every now and then, but I mean, completely cutting off family. What do you hear? What's that like? How emotional does it get when you talk to people on either end?
So I think that's one of the myths of estrangement, that estrangement is a complete cut off or it's final. Really, estrangement is more of a continuum where you can either be more or less estranged. And actually, people often go through multiple times of trying to create distance before they're able to maintain a level of distance that's right for them. And so it's actually the maintaining of the distance that's often more difficult than accomplishing it in the first place. Sometimes I can say, you know, I don't want to talk to you, but then the holidays roll around or there's a wedding or a funeral, and then I have to renegotiate that boundary. Am I going to talk to them in this moment or am I not going to go? So I think that for each person, it's really individual, and that maintenance is really hard because the culture is kind of sucking you back in, right? You're defaulting to this idea that families are together. So it's very hard to maintain that distance, even if you're able to create it.
Yeah, everywhere you look, there's happy scenes of families. I'm reading about a mother whose friends all post on Facebook what happens when their children come home and hers do not. So there's that.
And it's really difficult, actually, for everyone in the family, not just, so specifically, we often look at parents and children, but the immediate family is also suffering quite a bit because people are forced to take sides and also have to negotiate what that is. So if a child decides to distance themselves from one parent, oftentimes that means they feel they have to distance themselves from the other parent as well.
But again, you say, at least in the moment, find what feels like family to you, no matter who you are in this picture.
Yeah, absolutely. We can choose to have the people in our lives who really can support us and provide us the comfort and the camaraderie of family. And for people who are looking to support people who are going through the estrangement process, even though their first reaction might be to say, I'm so sorry, it's so sad, that these people have often been really courageous in creating this distance, and that some of the best things we can do is to accept their decisions to create distance and not ask for details that people aren't ready to provide.
And for them, it may not be sad at all.
Exactly.
It may be a saving grace.
Yeah. So yeah. Like we would, if our friend told us that they were going to leave an abusive relationship, we'd be so happy for them. But for some reason, when it comes to families, we encourage people to return to those relationships all the time.
That's Christina Sharp, Assistant Professor of Communication at the University of Washington and one of the few scholars in the world on estrangement. Christina, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
The two biggest political races in Florida were called over the weekend, nearly 2 weeks after Election Day. Yesterday, Democratic incumbent Bill Nelson conceded to Republican Rick Scott in the Senate race. And on Saturday, Democrat Andrew Gillum conceded to Republican Ron DeSantis in the governor's race. But what about how the elections were handled? Florida has a history of ballot irregularities. If you remember the presidential election recount there in 2000, it is an important battleground state and has some serious work to do to improve its voting system before 2020. Joining us now is Edward Foley, director of the Election Law Program at Moritz College of Law at Ohio State University. Professor, welcome.
Good to be with you.
So what were the biggest problems in Florida as you see them?
Well, partisanship. You had partisanship at the local level, at the state level, and it's hard for voters to trust the system if they think the people in charge are rooting for one team or the other. I mean, there were other problems. There was infrastructure issues on the ground. You had old machines that didn't work properly that overheated during the recount. You had a process for verifying absentee votes that, again, is antiquated given the way signatures work in American society. But I would say the biggest issue is how we run competitive elections. You want elections to be competitive in a democracy. Both parties are entitled to fight hard to win. But in any competitive situation, you need umpires or referees that aren't rooting for one side or the other.
Well, and that brings me to the ballot design, which is something that we saw back in 2000. I remember the butterfly ballot. And then there was an issue with the design this year as well. Why aren't these ballots just standard all across the country in terms of how they're designed?
Well, good point. Elections are run in America at the local level, not just at the state level, but at the local level. So you have every county designing its own ballots because they're local races as well as statewide races on the ballot. Unfortunately, you can't have a perfect election. It's a human process and we're humans. We're imperfect. So we cannot inoculate ourselves from a bad ballot design. And it's terrible because it means that voters sort of overlooked a race that you presume that they wanted to vote for. But
do you think that's by design, though? Do you think that those ballots were designed to be complicated so that people would leave off one of the races?
No. I think that's an example of just administrative error. There's a slogan in the election law world, don't assume evil when it could be incompetence at work.
Uh-huh.
So I think I would attribute that to human failure. Yeah.
What about the fact that many of these counties and these counties that we all know so well now, Broward County and Palm Beach County, that it takes them so much longer to count the votes than anywhere else in the country?
Well, no, I'm not sure that's true. I mean, I think we're used to, or we were conditioned in the 20th century to think that we would get results on election night. We've put in reforms since 2000 that are good reforms, but they have the collateral consequence of delaying the process. So we have provisional ballots, which cannot be counted on election night because of their provisional nature. You have to review them to see if they're eligible. And now we rely so much more on absentee ballots than we used to. As long as they're postmarked by Election Day, they're eligible to be counted. Some states out west, like Washington and California, will count them up to 10 days or 2 weeks after Election Day. We saw the Arizona race this year change from election night result to the eventual winner being of the opposite party because of having to count mail-in votes. So these are two important reforms, but they have the consequence that we, in a close race, we're not going to know the answer on election night.
So what needs to be done? What would your one piece of advice to, let's say, the state of Florida be at this point about how to get things ready for 2020?
Come up with an institution that both sides can trust, particularly for the counting process. Most democracies around the world have moved to nonpartisan election administration. So Britain and Canada and Australia, you know, other countries that we share our legal heritage from, you know, coming from Britain, they want to take partisanship out of the voting process. We allow partisans to run the system both in the front end of the process and at the back end. And this is particularly problematic at the back end when you have a close election and you want to be able to trust the institution that counts the votes.
How damaging is it when somebody who is running for office, or even in this case, the president of the United States, when they look at what's happening and they say there's fraud, people are changing votes, they're finding votes that shouldn't exist, that kind of thing. How damaging is that for elections in general?
Well, this is the aspect of what happened this year that worries me the most for thinking about 2020. I thought that the rhetoric very quickly got very overheated, disproportionate to what was happening on the ground. I mean, these races in Florida were close, but they were still 10,000 votes apart, not 100 votes or 1,000 votes. And there wasn't evidence in existence that which suggests that the system was rigged or being stolen. And so the rhetoric jumped to conclusions that were, you know, out of proportion to the reality in a way that we didn't even see back in 2000. And that's not a good situation when both sides want to win a race. So if we had a repeat of that in 2020, that would be a dicey situation.
That's Edward Foley, who is the director of the Election Law Program at Moritz College of Law at Ohio State University. Professor, thank you.
Thank you.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.